Welcome to the Powered by Transova podcast, where Transova team members and industry experts will cover how our reproductive toolbox of embryo transfer, in vitro fertilization, sorted semen, and cloning technologies can multiply the success within your livestock breeding program. Throughout our series, we will also cover a wide array of topics such as frequently asked questions, management and care advice, as well as client and location highlights.
Emily here. Thanks again for joining the podcast. We are so happy that you have stuck with us through our first season of the Powered by Transova podcast, and we cannot wait to share what we have planned for season two, which will launch this fall. We are going to take the summer off to record and get back out and actually do things this summer. We're going to be going around to some of the junior nationals, some dairy events, some industry events as well. So if you're out and about, be sure to stop and see the Transova team. I know we'd all love to stop and talk to you. If there is something specific that you would want to hear on the podcast next season, or you want to hear someone specific talk, go ahead and shoot us an email at moreinformation@transova.com or send us an email on social media, and we'd be happy to make that happen for you. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast. That way you don't miss season two. And if you'd like, give us a rating. That's how others will find us, and we can continue to educate more people within our industry about advanced reproductive technologies. To wrap up our season here, the final three episodes are going to be recordings of Facebook Live events that we did this past winter. A lot of great information that we thought we needed to share again. Today's recording is of a Facebook Live event that we did this past February with Dr. John Schmidt and Dr. Matt Bartlett, who share a lot of their insight and discuss the common misconceptions around IVF in cattle. So they take questions live from the audience on Facebook and also had some prepared questions as well to kick off our discussion with them. So we hope that you enjoy this discussion with Dr. John and Dr. Matt. We are joined today with myself, Emily Warnemont, part of the marketing team, and Sarah Kober from also the marketing team. We are going to be moderating this session. And with us today, we've got Dr. John Schmidt and Dr. Matt Bartlett, who are going to talk all things IVF misconceptions. So I'll let those guys introduce themselves and give you guys a little bit of info before we start taking questions.
Thanks, Emily. My name is Matt Bartlett. I'm one of our veterinarians on staff. I've been with Transova for 13 years. I currently fill the role of our Plains Regional Operations Manager, and I spend a lot of my time in the field in North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa.
And my name is John Schmidt. I've been with Transova, it'll be 17 years here in May as a veterinarian, right out of vet school. I, like Matt, spend some time out in the field, mainly in South Dakota these days when I'm in a cow. And then when we're back at headquarters there in Sioux Center, I also help support our teams from an operational management standpoint. So today we're going to spend the first few minutes of the Facebook Live session here kind of going back and forth with some of the more often questions that Matt and I see out in the field as we interact with clients, and maybe give some level of answer or detail or clarity as to maybe what some of those misconceptions or myths might be out there. So Matt, I'll start with you first. One of the often things we hear is my IVF embryos just don't make near as many pregnancies as my ET embryos. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I think over the years, there's definitely been some truth to that historically. I think that's certainly been the goal as the technology has developed, is to continue to make a IVF embryo be as close to a conventional ET embryo as we can. And I think over the years, we consistently see that gap between them closing. In our most current data, I guess what I've always told people, and I think is our current data would support it, is that a fresh IVF embryo will perform very similar to a frozen ET embryo. when we compare directly the frozen ET versus a IVF frozen, our data set shows that there's usually about a 3 to 5% difference. And when you go from a fresh to a frozen product, both ET or IVF, you're going to see about a 5% reduction in preg rate. At the end of the day, in addition to the embryos and their performance, recipient management plays a huge role in your success of how those embryos are going to perform in your herd. The variations that we see with these embryos in the field is usually tied much, very directly to the recipient herds and the management and the things that happen as those embryos are implanted and the recips are prepared and then managed there on out. Anything to add there, John?
Oh, you did a great job.
John, one of the ones I hear is that IVF embryo pregnancies, they see more loss or abortions compared to their ET embryos.
So at Transova, we work with a large toolbox of tools there. And even just when you look at reproductive toolbox, you've got natural breeding, AI, embryo transfer, IVF, and cloning is one of the other tools that we see. And historically, as you move through the technologies and the advancement of those, you'll see differences in loss with that. And so in general, our benchmarks are is you, I'm going to talk about like point loss there. And so we'll see about a 1 to 2 percentage point drop with natural cover and AI pregnancies. Add another 2 points or so when you go to a conventional ET embryo. So you're at, you know, 2 to 4 points of loss there. And you can add maybe another 1 point. So 3 to 5 points with that once you get to an IVF embryo. And so as you and so on with the cloning. And so you'll see slight differences there, although I think some people make those differences to be out much greater than they actually are. We always need to consider management factors and environmental factors that come into play with that. And there's a variety of nutritional, environmental, and disease type factors that go into pregnancy loss. And if you're above what we're kind of describing there, we certainly need to take a look into what some of those other outside factors might be outside of the technology. Matt, we often get some feedback that my IVF embryo, the calves from my IVF embryos are larger as compared to the rest of my calves. What do you have to say about that?
Sure. Yeah. And I think some of that is, again, going back to the development of the technology over the years. I mean, I think early on in the 90s, we definitely, as we took embryos out, oocytes out of cows and tried to culture them in our laboratories, we certainly identified and had a very real problem in large offspring syndrome. I think that was identified before my time in the early 2000s with Transova as some of the factors that play into those medias and culture settings that influence and can create those situations. Over the years, Transova has identified a lot of those factors within our own medias, and we constantly try to improve that. And again, as we try to create as normal or as embryo as compared to the conventional ET embryos, we want live calves on the ground. And so we've seen that that incidence and the amount of time that you see or number of times that you see large calves coming from IVF calves greatly diminish. Certainly can't say that it never happens because, we're playing with nature. We're influencing that in the laboratory. And so there's times where you're going to see some large calves, but that seems to be few and far between. In addition to the media, I always think it's important for guys to understand that there's a lot of other factors that go into what happens with those gene expressions and what's happening with the embryo as it's going through gestation. And so there's environmental factors. We oftentimes see if we are going to see large calves or get a report of a large calf here and there, it's generally going to be related to weather and natural or and the timing of the year. So when we look at our data set, we see birth weights increase a little bit when we get into March and April. And a lot of that is because you have cows that are, you know, at that time, not as active. They're trying to stay warm in some of our colder climates. That naturally has an effect where you pull blood into your core. And when you do that, we can sometimes see some elevated weights. But that's true for regardless of whether it's a bull bred natural AI or bull bred or AI or an ET calf, you can see those same kind of effects there. A lot of times when we dig deeper into where we see some of those large calves that do appear in our system that generate from, or that are generated from IVFs, there's also oftentimes that it's tied back to a specific mating or the history of a bull and a bull that's involved in that, that or the cow side that can be a factor that contributes to that as well. At the end of the day, I think reset management is key, is we've got to be cognizant when we have IVF pregnancies or any pregnancies that we don't overfeed and we're cognizant of our nutritional planes during the third trimester. And then certainly, you know, how we manage those recips when they are going to calving, making sure that we are aware that there can be times that some of those recips will go overdue, and making sure that we stay on top of that and don't let those recips go out to the extremes as far as past their due dates when we would expect it. So I guess that would be my comments on the large calves. Anything to add there, John?
I'll maybe add that one thing unique about our system and at Transova is that we have the ability to track this, and we're calving out IVF and a few ET pregnancies on a weekly basis through our live calf system. So we can monitor calf size, birth weights, et cetera, which has been very stable over the years. And even several of us have a personal experience with that. So I know Dr. Faber, the president of our company, and myself, between the two of us, we'll probably calve in over 100 embryo pregnancies here this spring. We have some personal herds that we have as a side gig or whatever. And so we can I guess get some personal experience there too. So, that's what I might add there.
Very good. John, one of the comments that I will often hear is that sexed IVF embryos have a lower preg rate than embryos from conventional semen. Do you see any variation in the preg rates depending on what type of semen is used?
Actually, in preparation for this here today, I did look at those on one of our reports yesterday, and there is less than a 1 to 2. When you look across all different kinds of semen types used to create these embryos, there is no statistical difference in whether and how those embryos are made. We will see that you can generally expect an extra half of an embryo or at most to an embryo more of grade one embryos when you are not sorting that semen. And so we all know that generally speaking, the embryo quality does translate to pregnancy rate. And so if we can get more grade one embryos, we'll maybe influence pregnancy rate that way. And our grade ones, you know, we'll usually see about a 7 to 8 point advantage with grade ones over twos. And so if we're able to do that, there's maybe a slight advantage there. But in general, when you just look at an embryo made with normal or reverse sort or sex frozen semen, there is no difference in pregnancy rate there. So Matt, going on to the next question, we have some guys who feel like they're going to get more embryos or pregnancies if they flush a cow conventionally over running and her into an IVF program. What do you have to say about that?
Sure. So I think that's kind of a loaded question a little bit, because it's we can certainly talk about averages, but at the end of the day, you know, we always talk about the toolbox and what's right for the specific operation and the specific donor that you're flushing. Is you're going to have donors that perform very well in conventional, and some of those will translate over to IVF, and likewise, you're going to have some that perform very well in IVF and maybe struggle conventionally. And so I think picking the right tool for your donor is always a conversation that we want you to have with our professional service teams and our CSR client service representatives within within our team to figure out what's right with you. If we talk just on averages, you know, conventional flushing is usually going to average 6 to 7 embryos per flush historically, talking specifically beef cows. If you look at that same pool in IBF, mature beef cows in our system are creating 7 to 8 total embryos. And so there's from a production standpoint on averages, a place where IVF has caught up at least, maybe you can make the argument is slightly ahead of what we get on our conventional flushes. But again, there's a lot of difference and variation from donor to donor. In regards to pregnancies, I think that goes back to the initial question that we talked about. There is you know, that gap continues to close. And a lot of that comes back down to how we're setting up and how we're managing those recipient herds as to what we see, which one of those embryos is going to make more pregnancies and get more live calves on the ground at the end of the day.
Awesome.
John, in the industry right now, there's a lot of discussion as to you know, within IVF, is it better to stimulate or not stimulate? I think there's pros and cons on both sides. Where do you land on that?
Sure. And we'll maybe use this as our last question to open it up to the rest of the team. But I love parking on the whole toolbox tailored to your donor theme here. And that is one thing that we'll do with stimulation. So we believe that there really is no one way to approach donors in an IVF stimulation. It really depends on what the goals are within a program, and it also depends on the donor. So we'll see an advantage when we give those cows stimulation drugs. An embryo, it's varied. We've looked at this the last 3 years because we do a considerable amount of stimulation and a variety of stimulation and a variety of stimulation schedules within that. And we've seen anywhere from very little difference to an embryo difference or so with stimulation. We do see an advantage to quality grade one embryos, probably a 10 to 20% advantage there in production there. But it is just so donor dependent. We have donors that work extremely well without stimulation, and there's really no advantage to giving it. When you throw an embryo cost calculator at this question, we did this a couple of years ago. It really didn't take, it took about two embryos or an embryo half and a half more to pay for the FSH. And so if you're getting more than that, then it probably pays to throw the drugs at the cows. But then in some scenarios, we've got guys who bring the cows out of the pasture into the chute. We aspirate them without any drugs. And from a convenience standpoint, it's very suitable for their management settings as well. And so we approach this from a therapeutic standpoint. We identify the needs of the client, the kind of donors that we're running, the logistical situation that we're in to get those oocytes collected and assist the clients in making the best decision on whether or not we should stimulate those cows or not. So I think we were hoping to spend about 15 minutes talking about prepared questions. I guess we've got a few more to get through if we run out of questions from the audience and stuff, but Emily, I think we should probably turn it over to you now and let's hear from what our audience, what they would like to hear about this topic.
John and Matt, I think you've done a great job giving a lot of good information already, and there are some questions rolling in, and I just want to remind everybody that if you have questions, go ahead and put them in the comment section. You can see that a few of them are already on there. We will tackle the first one that came in. John or Matt, could you tell us a little bit about what you find? You've already talked about conception rates a little bit, but what are the differences in conception rates between grade ones and grade twos? Can you give us a little more insight on that?
That was one of our questions coming in there. When we look at grade one and grade twos, usually, John, I'm looking for that.
I think we usually see about a 7 to 8 point difference, percentage point difference when we compare grade ones and twos. So It's, and I've seen anywhere from 5 to 8 points of difference there over the years.
Perfect. Our next question here, can you only do IVF on pregnant donors, and how do heifers respond in IVF? So kind of a two-parter there.
Yeah.
No, great question. I've heard that a couple times over the we can only do IVF in pregnant donors. Actually, the pregnant donors is one of the cool places that we can do IVF. When we talk about conventional, until IVF, we weren't able to capture that value or get collections off of pregnant animals because of the needing to have access to the uterus. With IVF, you don't need that. And so the same thing is true across the other modalities or the production stages of the cow. So open cows, young virgin heifers are certainly other places that we can apply it. When we get into talking about virgin heifers, specifically on the beef side, you know, I think you have to, again, going back to that therapeutic approach, there's going to be more variability in a virgin beef heifer and how she performs in IVF that you're going to see based on how she was, what's happened to her life up to that point, what breed she is, and just some of her genetic base on the background as to whether she's able to make embryos at a high clip right away or she needs a little bit more time to continue to grow and mature. I think as we see more and more people using IVF as a tool in virgin heifers. And I think it's a great way to access those genetics and get some matings out of those heifers before, you know, a year or two before you'd be able to use some of those power matings and that kind of stuff in a normal setting. So, John, what else do you have to add there?
Yeah, we certainly need to be mindful that our expectations for embryo production out of heifers is less than cows. We generally, and Matt and I come from a beef background, so I feel a little bad for this being more beef slanted than dairy and that, but that's probably where more of our experience comes from. And we're generally in that 4 to 5 embryos per OPU range with heifers over that 7 to 8 with beef cows. So we need to lower our expectations there a little bit, but that's what I would add on the heifer side of things. Emily, what was the first question on that?
It was about, can you only do IVF on pregnant donors? And right. I think it's also good to note that you can IVF on pregnant donors. I think there's always questions about that.
Yeah, no, I just had a client haul in a dairy cow last week, and he asked me that question exactly. He's like, well, I wish we could run my other cows with this. And I corrected his misconception that it was only available in pregnant animals. You know, one thing right now, we've got a lot of guys calving in cows, and we can start as soon as, you know, 30 days or so postpartum, we can start collecting oocytes on cows. You can probably push that envelope if you even wanted to down to, I've done all my own animals, I guess, in the 20s as far as postpartum. So there's some neat tools with that before a cow is even cycling postpartum where you can collect on that. So it's a very, it's a much more versatile tool, IVF is, over embryo transfer, and be mindful too that we can get a collection on that cow every other week as compared to every 5 to 6 weeks where we are in conventional flushing.
Real quick, John, I'd probably circle around. You brought up a good point that we were coming from the beef side. On the dairy side, we regularly do virgin heifers. In fact, that's become the dominant donor animal in the dairy industry. Pushing those envelopes and trying to move the genetics as fast as we can. We're collecting IVF through IVF donors that are 6 to 7 months. And a lot of those dairy donors that are getting collected in today's industry are in that, you know, 8 to 15 month range before they're getting bred on. That's where majority of donors are getting collected. And so certainly is a viable tool. when you get to talking about heifers, I guess one of the things that's always amazed me as we do multiple collections, especially on the dairy side, is how well those heifers breed back. You know, when it comes to getting them bred, and at the end of the day with a heifer, the most important thing is to get her bred in a timely fashion. And it seems like we can do that with a fairly reliable and minimal effects on that breed back effect and with IVF.
Moving on to another question that has rolled in. Do you think it is better to implant grade twos right away and freeze grade ones? What are your recommendations in terms of the different grades of embryos and the freezing and fresh implants?
That's going to be just real situational and dependent on the client's goals and what their availability of recipients are. We do have access to a recipient pool at a couple of our locations, I think at three of our locations, to accommodate some of those lower grade embryos going in, even the grade threes. We only do a lot of grade three non-freezable transfers into those. But when it comes to grade two, anytime, what I guess the mentality I want clients and people to understand is anytime we freeze an embryo, regardless of whether it's a grade one or two, we do damage some of the cells with that through that freezing process. And you're going to take a 5 to 7 point hit on pregnancy rate when we freeze that embryo. And it's regardless of whether it's an ET or an IVF, is you're going to take, it seems like about a 5 to 7 point hit on preg rates. So I don't know that we see a more dramatic impact on freezing with grade twos over grade ones. So you just kind of need to line up those expectations with what you can handle as a, in your program and what you want, and make a decision tailored to your specific deal. So I personally have quite a few grade twos in my tank. And so that's the choice that I make. I don't have access to fresh recipients in my own program. And so that's what I'm limited to. And it's just very situational and client dependent. Matt, anything to share?
I'd add to that, John, just that, you know, from a lab perspective, our team in the labs are very cognizant when they're doing that freezing process that they're not free. If they don't think it has a good chance to make a pregnancy, they're not going to freeze it. And so, I guess I have a lot of confidence in the grade one or grade two. If our lab has frozen it, they have confidence that there should be a good chance that that embryo makes a pregnancy.
Our next question here says, what would you expect conception rates to be in Holstein cows and heifers receiving embryos? Obviously, can be a large range depending on management, but what do you shoot for?
You want that one, John, or you want me to go?
Well, if we bounce back and forth, I can tackle that one. When we talk about preg rates and even embryo expectations, we generally function with a range, because as the person who asked the question highlighted, there are so many different factors there, and it really we better relate pregnancy rate expectations to maybe what your AI rates are in the herd. And so I think I've seen the figure about, you know, expect pregnancy rates to be about 80% that with an embryo to be 80% that of AI rates. I think, Matt, you can correct me if I'm wrong in that, but in the dairy world, I think that 80% number is what we're focused on in the dairy world of. So, you know, basically take your AI rates times 80%, and that should be a realistic expectation of where you're at, I guess, with a range of 5 to 10 points either way, or 5 points either way. So you're probably at a 10% range there on either side. So Matt, any comments there on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think as a general rule, our target in a dairy setting is to get the embryo to perform at the same level as sex semen has been in their operation. And so there's some management things that go into that and getting to that level. But I think that's a reasonable level and a reasonable expectation to set at the dairy level. The other thing that I would just add to that is again, it goes back to the embryo type and quality of the embryo that's going into your recipient herd. That's going to play a role there too. So, you know, as we talked about a little bit on the beef side of virgin heifers and quality of embryos and that kind of stuff. There's certainly things that we can gain from going after some of these younger heifers and that kind of stuff. But if you have more grade twos, you're going to have a lower preg rate. So
I'm going to give you the next question, and it's a little bit of a long one, so bear with me. Have you seen a difference in conception of IVF eggs between the lower stages versus the higher stage embryos? Example, stage 5 versus stage 7. I've heard some people say they have better conception with lower stages. If that's the case, can you freeze them at stage 5 instead of 7?
Yeah, so that's a good question and a frequent one that we hear. Interesting, I think you have people on both sides of that. You have certainly have people that prefer the 7s and 8s versus the 5s and 6s. So we look at it in our system as to right stage at right time, and so that is in relation to the rest of the embryos that are within a mating. So if within a mating, you have embryos that are congregated in that 6 to 7 range, and then we have 4s, I'm a little bit hesitant to transfer that stage 4 embryo and expect the same results, because it seems like it's a little bit behind the rest of the group. When you know, likewise, if we have, that can go on both sides. So, we'd see very little difference, I guess, across the stages when we talk about 5s through 7s, 5s through 8s. Usually within three points, I think, as you go across the different stages there, that they all perform fairly accurate. John, you were showing me a model on that here yesterday. You got anything to expand on that?
Yeah. One of our statisticians within our company, she did a statistical analysis on several thousand transfers into Transova recipients and saw no statistical difference between, you know, we were trying to find interactions between stages of the embryo and also the recipient synchrony there. And when it comes to stages of the embryos, there was, and even within then that whole set, there was really no statistical interactions there that were significant, you know, outside of maybe trying to stay away from a day 6. I'm getting off topic here with this question, but with a day 6 recipient, once you get to 6.5, 7, 8, there is no statistical difference there. And then when you tie in that embryo and what stage that embryo is, there's no interactions there. When you look at, like you, Matt said, there's about a 3-point difference when you look across the 5, 6, and 7 staged embryo there. So when you want to run the model against it, no significant difference there.
Great. So John, when we talked earlier in the week, this was kind of going to be like a myth buster session of these questions and everything. And I think this next one is really good into this whole theme of misconceptions. And they ask, do you see a difference in IVF embryos produced from oocytes affected by distance of satellite versus at Sioux Center? Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, no, I can, so long as we get those oocytes to the lab in time in an incubator that's functional, there is absolutely no difference in the way that those oocytes are actually handled. In fact, they are transported to the lab in the same vessel to media, whether they're on site there or at our satellite center. At least that's the case, you know, in Sioux Center for sure, because our collection sites are separate from our lab there in Sioux Center. And so, but we've looked at that, and we look at development rates by satellite center. And when you look at the big picture of things, our development rates for in-clinic, satellite, or on-farm, we're not seeing differences there to be concerned about discontinuing collection at one of those locations. So they all offer a lot of opportunity and advantages, and over others. And so we feel very comfortable collecting in the right setting. We always, if we're going to go on farm to a new location, to a client's farm, we got to certainly get some eyes on that facility and make sure the lab is adequate and our collection facility is we can have enough control over the environmental factors there. But once we have those approvals, we tend to get along really, really well.
To add a quick shameless plug to that, if you're interested in learning more about our locations, they're all listed on our website. They've got a neat map that outlines where all of those opportunities are. Mm-hmm. You guys have already touched a little bit on pregnant donor and IVF. One of the questions that came in is there an ideal window of how long they should be bred in order to perform IVF? Is there like a unique time that it works the best?
Well, I think Matt took the last one first, so I'll run with it. I don't know. Matt, you want me to run with this one first initially?
I can run with it. Okay. Generally we talk about a 40 to 100 day window is the ideal time to bring a pregnant donor to us for the first time. Now, we certainly have clients that push and challenge those windows. We've got guys that breed in between collections and then all the way through from the time that they, from the time of conception all the way through. I think at the end of the day, we want our clients to understand that in that first, up until that first 40 days, you can have early embryonic death that is whether you're in there or not in there, doing IVF collections. And so, you have to be aware of that. And when we say 40 days, that's a point where we feel like a good percentage of the, pregnancies are established and we're not going to see loss there. That's then going to get blamed on the procedure. When we talk about that 40 to 100 day window, that's the place where we really want to see those animals for the first time, because outside of that, we certainly have donors that can be collected out 5-6 months into gestation, but there's you don't know that if you're not in there at least ahead of time in that 140 to 100 day window and see how that animal is carrying that pregnancy. And that's unique to every single animal. Some animals will carry it up there high in their pelvis, and you can access those embryos almost amazingly throughout there for long, long periods throughout that pregnancy. You have other ones that hit that 100 day deal and they're dropping straight down. And that's when they start pulling those ovaries down and away from our probe that we can't easily manipulate that. That's usually where we're pulling the plug and saying, hey, we need to be wrapping up it. And we don't want to cause, you know, at the end of the day, we don't want to cause any harm or to the animal or that pregnancy if we can prevent it. And so, like I say, if we can get our hands on those animals, you know, before 100 days, usually we can give you a pretty good guidance as to, hey, we can keep going. There's no tension on this ovary, or, hey, one more time, or this needs to be the last time in IVF. But very donor specific. Feel free to add any more, John.
Yeah, I think you did well with that one.
So I think this next question builds off of what you guys were talking about pretty well. If doing multiple IVF on the same cow, does length of time between procedures make any difference with quantity that may be collected?
We've settled into a 2-week interval with this. There's been a fair amount of research early on done with this, and there's probably the systems now are different, and we'd love to be able to replicate some of the earlier research done there. But we settled in on a 2-week pattern here, and with stimulation in general, you could go to a weekly collection there without stimulation. If we're going to add stimulation there, we want 2 weeks of interval in between there. And there, what we'll do is we'll kind of read the donor's production and we'll go and run her on that interval until maybe she falls off her production. And then we will go ahead and if a donor is kind of a career donor where she's going to be open for a long period of time making embryos, we'll give them periodic breaks to kind of give their ovaries a little bit of a rest and to maybe recharge the batteries. And ultimately there are times where we just say, hey, this donor needs a longer rest, or we need to get this donor pregnant. And what we find is that pregnancy plus lactation equals reproductive reprogramming. It's kind of like rebooting your computer when things kind of just get bogged down. And so we utilize breaks like that to hopefully extend the lifespan of a cow's reproductive abilities in a program there. So I don't know that. I think I'm answering your question there. There's more to that question than what I'm answering here, though, Emily. What am I missing in part of that question? Or maybe Matt can ride with it.
Yeah, I just add that it's definitely donor specific. I mean, you'll have some donors that are going to fire every 2 weeks and never miss a beat for an extended period of time. And you'll have other donors that will run 2 and 3 times and then see a great decline. And I think that's true both on stimulation. And we've seen that same effect on with stimulation and without. You know, we always talked about with stimulation that you have a refraction effect there, that the receptors there see that FSH, you know, to a certain point, and they start reducing the amount of receptors that are available there. And so that's where that 2 week interval is built in there is we don't want those animals seeing exogenous FSH on a constant basis in their system. We got to give them a little bit of a break. With that said, like I say, very therapeutic, or you got to take a therapeutic approach and look at the specific donor as to how she's responding, as John alluded to. And there's places and situational things where we can go quicker than 2 weeks. And there's other places where we need to stretch that out. And so I think you just kind of have to look at the situation and listen to your donor or what she's telling you when you got your arm in her.
Yeah. And I'll maybe add one last thing within this one. We do tend to use less FSH in an IVF stimulation as compared to conventional flushing. And so that helps with the refraction that, or the immunity, as some people call it, that Matt talked about. And as he mentioned too, with young heifers, let's say specifically, we'll tend to maybe not run them quite as frequently and give them extra break in between sessions as compared to some of the mature animals.
And I'll just add too, I mean, your client service rep will help talk you through all of that because they are looking at results from time to time. And then also the vet that is doing the procedures, you guys will give that feedback to clients too, shoot side, if you think a donor needs rest and whatnot, right?
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a team approach there, even when it comes to evaluating what kind of schedule they're on, whether they're stimulated, not stimulated, how many shots to get, how many CCs and dose, and that it is very much a team approach and interaction between our technicians who are out there collecting the oocytes and the CSRs that are probably more on a client facing and delivering results and in the computer monitoring results and the fertilization event happens as the IVF process goes through, from fertilization through embryos shipped out the door or in the tank in a straw. Very much a team approach.
Definitely a lot of pieces to the puzzle. One other question that has come in is it worth transferring low quality embryos that are not freezable quality, considering that the price is per embryo?
Yeah. So I think that goes back to what is your specific situation? I mean, I think there's places where that maybe doesn't make sense depending on the value of the offspring and what that end game and end goal is. There's certainly places where every single pregnancy that we can get made off of a specific donor is well worth it, you know, sometimes tenfold, whatever that's going to cost you. And so I think that's situational, that you have to look at it. And that's where I would encourage you to, as a client, to, you know, don't just come and ask for the service. Sit down and talk with our professional service teams and our client service teams to really understand what the best way to take this technology and apply it to your specific operation is, because there's places there where things like low grades can add huge value. There's also places there where you know, I think it's the same discussion on stimulation or not stimulation and frequency running the donors and when to run them and whether to transfer fresh or you're going to be better on frozen. There's so many factors here that we can customize to your specific donor, your specific operation to help you have success. And the best way we can understand that is by having those discussions and catering something specific to you and your operation.
Very good.
Awesome. Well, we are at the end of our time here today. Thank you, John and Matt, for taking the time to sit down and chat and answer some of these common questions that we regularly get. And hopefully that was able to help some people.
We appreciate you tuning in to Transova. If you have any topics you'd like to hear more about, send an email to moreinformation@transova.com. Thank you.